This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT in Houston. And now, Houston's only primetime radio program dedicated to news and concerns of the lesbi, gay, and transgender identity. This is Queer Voices.
And this is the April 9th, 2007 edition of Queer Voices. I don't know what happened to the spring because it kind of went, I don't know.
It sprung.
It sprung a leak.
Yes.
But we are here.
It got cold feet.
Yeah. Oh. That's so cute.
Oh, God.
You thought of that all by yourself.
I really did. It's a blonde thing.
Okay.
You know, even though I was indoors, I heard that we actually had a snow flurry Saturday.
Yeah.
Here, all the way in Houston.
Yeah. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, that doesn't happen often. Well, of course, I'm Deborah Bell.
And Jennifer Renee.
And Glenn Holt.
And that's the Queer Voices crew for tonight. We will be hearing from correspondent Joan Devlin. She'll be talking to Andy Koppelman about his book, Same Sex, Different States, about his research and book regarding the so-called defense of marriage laws.
And then Jeff Reed's going to be, will join us for his insight on politics here in 2007. After that will be Rose Wall, volunteer coordinator with the Transgendered Unity Banquet, which comes up this weekend.
All right.
Yes, it's going to be a big event. Ray Hill's going to be the keynote speaker.
All right. And because April is, among other things, Sexually Transmitted Infections, STD Awareness Month, Brian Rydell from the Montrose Counseling Center will talk to us on those issues. Plus, Aaron Coleman will join us as we kick off Poetry Month. He will be hosting an evening of poetry, jazz, and art on April 13th at Baring and James, and we're going to talk to him a little bit more about that. All that, plus This Way Out, music, and more.
Absolutely. It sounds like a good show.
On Queer Voices.
I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending April 7th, 2007. The capital city of Melbourne in the Australian state of Victoria began acknowledging same-gender couples on April 2nd with the official launch of its Relationship Declaration Register. Melbourne's Gay and Lesbian Choir performed for about 100 council mayors, LGBT activists, journalists, and same-gender couples and their families. Openly gay Deputy Lord Mayor Gary Singer told the crowd that even though the registry is only symbolic, a dedicated, committed relationship exists by the force of love, not law. On the same day, news broke that Victoria Premier Steve Bracks had asked Attorney General Rob Hulls to provide advice on whether a relationship registry open to same-gender couples could be set up statewide. However, Hulls was quick to announce that gay marriage is not on the agenda. According to some government sources, a Victorian registry would provide some legal rights and be based on a similar registry in effect in the state of Tasmania since 2004. Same-gender couples there can receive a certificate granting them legal rights to make medical decisions for their partners or to deal with government agencies. Registration also gives partners access to relationship rights such as wills, property division, health care, state superannuation and pension plans, and the right to adopt each other's children.
New Hampshire moved closer this week to joining a handful of other U.S. states that have created civil unions for same-gender couples. The House overwhelmingly voted to give gay and lesbian couples the same rights, responsibilities, and obligations as married couples. Same-gender unions from other states would be recognized if they're legal in the state where they were performed. The House soundly defeated a proposed constitutional amendment to ban same-gender marriage in late March. The civil unions bill now goes to the Senate, where political pundits say it's got a good chance of passage. Democratic Governor John Lynch opposes same-gender marriage, but has thus far avoided taking a position on the civil unions legislation. A civil unions bill was introduced in the Illinois state legislature in late February and passed in the House Human Services Committee in late March.
Massachusetts is the only U.S. state that offers full marriage equality for its residents. And this week, Democratic Governor Deval Patrick ordered officials to record the marriages of 26 out-of-state gay and lesbian couples that were denied recognition by former Republican governor and now prospective presidential candidate Mitt Romney. The state's Supreme Judicial Court ruled in March 2006 that Romney could invoke a 1913 law to deny out-of-state couples the right to marry in Massachusetts if their home state specifically prohibits them. Patrick, who is African American, also said this week that he would like to sign legislation to repeal the 1913 law, which was originally enacted to prohibit the marriages of biracial couples.
An Indiana State House subcommittee this week rejected a proposed constitutional ban on same-gender marriage on a 5-5 tie vote, which meant its defeat. And the state of Maryland's House Judiciary Committee soundly defeated a proposed constitutional amendment in late March that would also have banned marriage rights for same-gender couples. But the state Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee refused to advance a bill that would have prohibited discrimination on the basis of gender identity and expression.
Voters in Alaska have asked state lawmakers to pursue a constitutional amendment to strip domestic partner benefits from gay and lesbian public employees. Unofficial returns showed 55% of voters in favor and 45% opposed. This week's vote has no binding authority on the legislature, but backers hope that passage of the proposal will pressure lawmakers into putting the amendment back before voters, this time for a binding vote, in the November 2008 general election. Alaska's Supreme Court last year ordered the state to extend domestic partner benefits in a lawsuit brought by several same-gender couples, ruling that to deny them was a violation of Alaska's constitutional guarantee of equal protection. In a November special session, lawmakers passed a bill attempting to reverse the ruling, but it was vetoed as unconstitutional by Republican Governor Sarah Palin. However, she opposes the benefits and said she would support a legal means to end them. This week's non-binding vote was the only measure on the ballot, which according to state estimates cost taxpayers about $1.2 million.
In other news this week, organizers of Moscow's LGBT Pride March have asked the Russian Supreme Court to overturn a lower court ruling that upheld the city's decision to ban it. Activists marched despite the ban last year and were violently attacked by skinheads, fundamentalist Christians, and neo-fascists. About 200 people were arrested, mostly LGBT Pride marchers. The appeal to the Supreme Court asks that last year's decision be overturned and that the city be stopped from banning this year's parade. Moscow officials have already announced a ban of that march, scheduled again for May 27th, the anniversary of the repeal of Russia's sodomy laws. The Supreme Court has not yet indicated if it will hear the appeal. Moscow activists have also taken the issue to the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, asking it to rule that the ban on peaceful LGBT marches violates the European Convention.
Meanwhile, at a meeting with queer activists in late March, the mayor of Reykjavik, Iceland, agreed to fund that city's Pride festivities for the equivalent of $180,000 a year for the next 3 years, according to a report in the Morgenbladet newspaper. During the meeting, the mayor reportedly kissed the hand of a local drag queen who's a member of the Pride Committee.
15 students at Istanbul's Bilgi University have set up the nation's first LGBT student club, according to a March 29th report in the Turkish Daily News. The Bilgi Gugasagi LGBT Club applied for and received official university approval. The club meets weekly and is open to any student who wants to fight homophobia. The group plans to establish a fanzine and to hold forums and workshops with other student clubs.
The first gay-themed talk show to appear in China debuted online this week, with the host and guests discussing the challenges of being gay or lesbian in the world's most populous country. The first of 12 episodes of Gay Connections appeared on the website of Hong Kong-based broadcaster Phoenix Television and three other sites. Host Didier Zhang, a French-educated gay man and AIDS activist, kicked off the show with a discussion with the lesbian owner of a Beijing gay bar. Other guests exchanged tips on how and where to meet other LGBT people. China has a lesbi-gay population estimated in the tens of millions, but homosexuality is still a largely taboo subject in the country due to a mix of traditional conservatism and communist prejudice. Sodomy was decriminalized there in 1997, and homosexuality was removed from medical handbooks as a mental disorder in 2001. Government disapproval has softened somewhat since then. Authorities have even allowed some officially sanctioned gay internet chat rooms in Beijing. However, Chinese authorities remain nervous about the subject and have blocked access to some overseas LGBT-oriented websites.
24-year-old Australian pop music star Anthony Kalea came out in newspaper interviews and on his website on March 27th. Kalea's number one hit, The Prayer, is the biggest-selling single in Australian history. "Yes, I am gay," Kalea wrote on his website. He'd previously denied that, for which he was roundly criticized. I want it clear that I am proud, happy, comfortable, and confident in who I am, he wrote. Things now feel right for me to share this part of my life. I am content. I've been in a long-term relationship with my partner, Paul, who has been by my side for the past 2.5 years. Together, we have the love and support of our family, friends, and peers. Openly gay High Court Justice Michael Kirby called Kalea an admirable Australian for coming out. In terms of influencing popular culture and understanding of the reality of human sexual diversity, Kirby said, I would trade 10 judges for one popular singer.
And finally,
when you wish upon a star, makes no difference who you are.
Sure to bunch the shorts of homophobes everywhere, the Walt Disney Company has decided to allow same-gender couples to have a fairy tale wedding. Disney had previously barred lesbi-gay couples from the special celebrations, but a company spokesperson said the change was prompted by an inquiry from a guest that asked about this service. The price tag for a fairy tale wedding starts at around $8,000 and includes a wedding planner, the ceremony, food and drink, flowers, and table decorations. The lavish wedding option also includes a ride to the ceremony in the Cinderella coach, costume trumpeters heralding the couple's arrival, and attendance by Mickey and Minnie Mouse characters dressed in formal attire. The packages will be available primarily at Disney's U.S. resorts in California and Florida and on its cruise line. Disney has already come under fire from religious conservatives led by the Southern Baptist Convention who've accused the company of promoting a so-called gay agenda by offering health benefits to the same-gender partners of its employees and allowing unofficial gay day celebrations at its theme parks. But we are not in the business of making judgments about the lifestyle of our guests, Disney Parks and Resorts spokesman Don Walker told reporters. We are in the hospitality business, and our parks and resorts are open to everyone.
That's News Wrap for the week ending April 7th, 2007. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap was written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Rick Watts.
And I'm Sherry Lund.
This is Queer Voices.
It sure is.
Yes, it is.
Very queer voices. And we're about to hear the queer voice of Aaron Coleman. Now, Aaron, you're a poet and an entertainer. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself for people that haven't heard you before on the show?
Well, hi there, Houston. I've been doing my poetry, I guess, seriously for about 10 years. And I now have a partner that I'm being produced by, David Flores Perez, and shout out to him. Hi, how you doing, baby?
Hey, David.
And we have Dos Osos Productions as our production company, and we have a website. It's www.2osos.com. And we have some featured music there. It's undergoing renovation, so we should have some poetry up soon. I've been a fixture in the Houston community, gay community, all kinds of communities for the last, like, 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And I have an event coming up on Friday.
Yeah, tell us a little. Well, first of all, like I said, April is among other things, because it seems to be, they said, let's use April and we'll just name all these different things to recognize or be aware of or whatever during the month of April. And it's a kind of weird assemblage. But one is Poetry, National Poetry Month.
National Poetry Month, and Tim Brookover of Outsmart Magazine called me up and said, will you do it? And I said, haven't I done it before? I will certainly do it again. And so we're having the second edition of Jazz, Poetry, and Art at Baring & James Gallery, the wonderful Baring and James Gallery, and the proprietors are Blakely Baring and James, Austin James, and the gallery is just a beautiful, beautiful place, and everybody should go and frequent there because it's
beautiful. They've done something really different for an art gallery space. They've, not only do they have wonderful works of art, but they've brought in the community, and they've had several different concerts. They had a play, they had Joe Watts,
all sorts of receptions
yeah. and events, and that's really good.
It's located at 805 Road Place, and Road is exactly one block from Taft, mm-hmm. off of Dallas, and it's Suite 500. And it's going to be this Friday.
It looks kind of like a warehouse strip.
Right.
But it's the one on
the left side.
If you're looking at the building, it's on the left side, the last
north
one.
Side.
North side. Oh, aren't you directional?
this Friday from 7 to 9, and we're going to have several artists, actually five, Christopher Whaley, who is the owner of Sobo Magazine. He produces that. It's a local music and entertainment magazine here in Houston. Philip Always Brent Sr. Austin James, the proprietor of Baring & James, is going to read. Anissa Calloway. Alice Fulks of A-Light Productions is going to read, and I'm going to host, but I will be reading some of my poetry, too.
All right. Well, let's take a...
I was going to say, maybe you have something with you tonight.
Just maybe, perhaps.
You could just give us a little tip thing.
Yeah, I do.
Oh, look at there.
Why don't we hear it now?
The Art of Seduction.
Oh, she's breathing heavy already.
Come in and rest from travails. And partake of the banquet feast I prepared. Step carefully upon the rose petals positioned expressly for your assault. Maneuver your way past objet d'art, no doubt reflecting your green eye, to the casting couch where we, juxtaposed, can talk. A pregnant pause leads or follows a Mona Lisa-esque smile. Inhale, exhale. Something aromatic in anticipation makes for prickly skin, goose flesh. The current is flowing, as is the wine of approval. We drink and savor the sensual oblivion. The stuff dreams are made of, clouds inhibition, breath quickens. Air doesn't seem enough. Eyes dart and flutter. Tongues dart and stutter. The house lights dim and fade. End of Act 1. Act 2 and Act 3 are being reviewed by an advisory board for content.
I love it.
Oh, that's good. That's good. You had me going there.
Yeah, really. the audience is probably like, like that. Well, that's just a sample of Erin Coleman's poetry, The Art of Seduction. And that will, more like that and others, will be this Friday from 7 to 9 at Baring & James Gallery. Now, Erin, what is your background? Did you study poetry in school? Were you a student or...
I went to a boys' choir school in Chicago where we sang liturgical music, and that's where I got my musical training. And that was in the early 60s when the Beatles were happening, and all of us wanted to be Beatles, no matter what color we were. And I got a guitar, and my sophomore high school English professor said, let's do poetry. And I was writing archaically, and she said, no, write like you're talking to people. And so I started writing poetry, and I put it together with a couple of chords, and I had a song. So that was my start. And I never really thought of myself as a writer. I just did it for fun, and until I realized that I could get my ya-yas out and by writing.
Uh-huh. And what inspires you?
Everything. People inspire me. Life events inspire me. Failures, triumphs, the stuff of life. Mm-hmm. You know, a beautiful day can inspire me.
How do you think poetry is different in the way it speaks to people and just telling a story?
I think poetry is, it's the verbal akin to music. music is a universal language. And I think poetry, whether it's poetry in another language, it resonates. It's the meter of it. It's the emotion that's put behind it that resonates with everybody, just like music does. And it speaks to people. It's expression. It's pure expression, like dance. Dance, music, and art, mm-hmm. And poetry are all forms of expression, human expression. Yeah.
I know when I was in school, we learned poetry, and then it all had to rhyme, and you know, iambic pentameter.
I learned that it doesn't have to rhyme.
Yeah, but what I found was, I guess it was in the 70s, and for me, it was Rod McEwen stuff. That was all
for
about,
me. It was Lawrence Ferlinghetti.
Okay, the free verse, and it was at that time that I gained voice, as far as poetry is concerned, from doing that. Because you didn't have to have it rhyming. You didn't have to do all of that, you know, mechanical work with it. It was more of a matter, just like you say, talking, painting a picture with words, if
exactly,
you will.
Exactly, exactly. Sometimes it's the choice of words. Sometimes it's the meter. And you really have a lot of tools at your disposal because words are so vast.
And other than a body of work that I did during the midst of teen angst, I have produced very little poetry, but I have a few that have, you know, come to me and that
come
I
on,
actually...
Come on, Deb, come on, get it out.
Every now and then I do.
Do you have a piece with
but,
you?
No, I don't. I didn't. But, you know, the women's group that meets at the Unitarian Church on Sunday mornings regularly has poetry sessions. And, of course, we have temporarily lost our wonderful Donna Garrett, who's working in Asia.
China.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
in Taipei, Taiwan, and doing some work trying to complete her book. But we have just like individual people who, you know, don't on a regular basis produce poetry, but they have written poems, and sometimes they just speak so much, you know, that you connect to it or you can relate to it, because it's like, yes, that happened in my, you know, maybe it's a story about an aunt at a family reunion or something. It just the things of everyday life can also tell beautiful poetry.
Just like I believe that everybody has a song in their heart, I think everybody has a poem in their heart.
And I think the practice or the discipline of producing poetry, putting it into the words that you need, not necessarily to rhyme, thank goodness, because, you know...
I never could do that.
And a lot of that gets old. I mean, there's only so many words that are going to rhyme, and mm-hmm. sometimes they take liberties with, you know, well, it's close enough.
Rhymes with orange.
Yeah, rhymes with oranges. I said we should...
What rhymes with zebra?
We should... Deborah.
But that's
the wrong way to spell my name. I don't spell it that way. Having the words form thoughts and evoke certain things. I mean, like it like paints a picture in your mind.
It does.
Yeah, and it's. Of course, then you get the people, they're going to do things like haikus and...
It's all good.
You know.
It's all good.
They're good little mental things to keep your mind active, which, you know, we all are, except maybe Jennifer, who's not aging, the rest of us, we have to keep our minds active
right.
in some way. Well,
I'm sorry.
What
I was going to say that a lot of times when you're writing it, you know, and you may just be writing down thoughts, and you're just, you know, alone and almost like a diary or something, and then you go back and reread it, you've written a poem.
You have.
See, and you don't realize it. I know that's how I found out I had a voice, was not because I sat down to write a poem, but I sat down to write down some feelings and thoughts.
Mm-hmm. And that's what poetry is. So I want to encourage everybody within the sound of my voice to make it a point to be at Jazz, Poetry, and Art, second edition at Baring & James, 805 Road Place, Suite 500, Friday from 7 to 9. It's free. donations are being requested that will benefit the gay and lesbian, the GLBT Community Center.
I was going to mention that, yes.
And it's being graciously underwritten by Outsmart Magazine, and there will be cheesecake and barbecue. How could you possibly
now,
resist?
Now, that's an interesting combination.
That's a Texas combination if I've ever heard one.
Texas meets
New York.
Catered by 3Ws, and they do the best cheesecake. And they do really good barbecues.
So. All right. That's pretty down home there. I like it. So let's get back to poetry a moment.
Mm-hmm.
Who are poets that really admire or have touched you, maybe that you like to emulate? Or
Lawrence Ferlinghetti. Dubby turned me on to Fernando Pessoa. I like Amiri Baraka. I love you put me on the spot. There's so many. There's so many that I love. I think Cassandra Wilson is a poet. I think Joni Mitchell is a poet.
Mm.
I really love Joni Mitchell. Her stuff is just it's pure poetry.
Mm-hmm.
That's who inspires me.
Mm-hmm.
That's who are my favorites.
And those people in David, they inspire you. And do you have more poetry you can share with us?
I've got one that's on the top of my head. It's,
okay. That's what
the only one I can... Can I stand up and read it?
No.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Take it to the bridge. Take it to the bridge and drop it off like a care you'll never see again. Take it to the bridge. You know the bridge that spans those troubled waters, teeming with sons and daughters, eating not to be eaten, moving so that oxygen will come streaming over their gills, exercising free will to stay immersed in that particular ocean. But oh, what a happy day when you can realize that you could throw fears and troubles away by taking it to the bridge.
Oh, very good.
Thank you, Aaron.
Marvelous.
That was
Thank
wonderful.
You,
so again, Aaron Coleman. Hold. I want to ask you about the jazz part. Is there?
Oh yeah, I've got a playlist for you, baby.
Who else playing?
I love jazz.
To you about the entertainment.
I've got Dee Dee Bridgewater. I've got Eddie Daniels, Dave Grusin, Chaka Khan, Bob Baldwin, Sarah Vaughan, Sting, Yellow Jackets, Bebel Gilberto, Ahmad Jamal, George Michael, Ricky Lee Jones, Take Six, Quincy Jones, Cassandra Wilson, Sandra St. Victor, Kurt Elling. That's all my favorites.
So the music is going to be mixed in with the poetry.
Mm-hmm.
So it'd be one of those happening kind of evenings.
Oh, yes. You got to come and get your jazz on, get your poetry on, and get your vibe on.
Yeah, so you'll have an evening of poetry, jazz, and art hosted by Aaron Coleman, benefiting the Houston Gay, Lesbian, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center. And if they want to get in touch with you, Aaron, the best way is?
Is Aaron Song. AaronSSongs@yahoo.com, or they can look up Bering and James, BeringandJames.com, and the information will be there.
That's wonderful. Thanks for being on Queer Voices. Up next, Joan Devlin talks with Andy Koppelman about his book, Same Sex, Different States.
Get ready, all you lovely girls. See those brawny feet. you want me. You know I can't believe it when I hear that you won't see me.
Don't you want me.
You know I don't believe you when you say that you don't need me.
Much too late to find. Did you change your mind? You better change it back or we will both be sorry. Don't you want me, baby? Don't you want me? Precious kisses, words that burn me. Lovers never ask you why. Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me cry? Do you really want to hurt me? Do you really want to make me broken down to the lowest turn. Been on the bottom line, sure ain't no fun. But if we should be evicted from our homes, we'll just move somewhere else. Still carry.
An album called Screamin' Party Anthems. That was Four Poofs and a Piano, and the track called Extreme 80s. This is Queer Voices. And now out to the hopefully thawed out cornfields of Iowa and Joan Devlin.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing very well, thank you. You know, we actually had snow flurries reported here on Saturday.
Yes, I know. I was in Dallas.
Oh, my
word.
Away
from the cold weather.
Well, you actually got real snow in Dallas.
Yeah. Can't escape it. It follows me everywhere.
Well, who you got on tonight?
Tonight we are talking to Andrew Koppelman, who is the author of Same Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines.
How you doing?
Andrew, are you with us?
Glad to be here.
Oh, great. I'm going to turn the volume up a little bit here. Yes, this book is very interesting because you've kind of given us a very good overview of some of the issues we're facing today as more and more states put into effect defensive marriage acts or defensive marriage laws, making marriages, same-sex marriages performed in one state illegal in another. And this was generally done in response to Massachusetts, of course, allowing same-sex marriage.
From Hawaii, it looked like Hawaii was going to be the first one, and so many states legislated in response to that.
So in previous books and articles, though, you had kind of shown yourself to be a very strong supporter of gay rights, yet in same-sex different states, you seem to be saying that states don't really have to recognize same-sex marriages or even civil unions performed in other states.
Well, in this book, I'm really just trying to be a lawyer and say, I mean, I am a law professor, and
right.
I'm just trying to get clear on what existing law is and what the law would look like if the courts just followed the rules already in existence. Because, I mean, it's true, I'd like to see same-sex marriage legalized all across the United States, but that's not going to happen. The reality is it's not going to happen. On the other hand, what I think the folks on the other side who want to stamp out same-sex marriage everywhere have to realize is that that's not going to happen either. The country is divided. It's going to stay divided for a long time, and it would be good to have coherent rules of law just so, I mean, the ambition
right.
in this book is much more modest. It's, I think, the book starts off with a quotation from Robert Jackson, who was a Supreme Court justice about 50 years ago, and he said, if there's one thing that the people are entitled to expect from their lawmakers, it's rules of law that will enable individuals to tell whether they are married, and if so, to whom. That seems to be a reasonable ambition.
Now, where does the full faith and credit provision of the Constitution come in?
It actually has very little to do with it. Article 4 of the Constitution has a provision called the Full Faith and Credit Clause that says that states have to give full faith and credit to each other's public acts, records, and judicial proceedings. And after the Hawaii case, a lot of people started saying, well, under full faith and credit, states are obligated to recognize marriages from other states. But, you know, I've gone and investigated this. There's not a single decision in all of American history in which a court held that. What full faith and credit means is that states have to recognize judgments after litigation. So that if I drive through an intersection and wreck your car and you sue me and you win a judgment, if I flee to another state, you can come after me and collect the judgment without relitigating it. That's all that full faith and credit means.
Could there be any basis for the Loving versus Virginia decision on interracial marriage? Could that be used as a basis?
Loving versus Virginia is a decision in 1967 where the Supreme Court held that the prohibition of interracial marriage, of marriage between blacks and whites, was unconstitutional. Before then, a number of states had prohibited marriages between black people and white people. That all went away in 1967. There is an analogous argument that you can make. It's an argument that, in fact, I've made before, which is that it's well settled that discrimination on the basis of sex is a constitutional problem, but so that the Virginia Military Institute isn't allowed to be all male. So the argument goes, well, let's see, if Ricky is allowed to marry Fred, but Lucy is not allowed to marry Fred, then assuming Fred would be a desirable spouse for either one, Ricky's being disadvantaged on the basis of his sex, and that's sex discrimination. I think this is a good argument, but I also think that the Supreme Court is not going to buy it anytime soon. So people who think that the Supreme Court is going to fix the same-sex marriage problem, it's just not the case. I can't count a single vote on the U.S. Supreme Court today that would vote to require every state to legalize same-sex marriage. It's just not going to happen.
Now, how would cases like the Lisa and Janet Miller Jenkins case, where they lived in Virginia, were married or actually had a civil union performed in Vermont, went back to Virginia and decided to end their relationship, but the situation there, too, was that they had a child, and this is still being litigated, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
How would you factor things like that in? Because the Lisa and Janet Miller Jenkins case, I mean, they're going to be happening.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's right. And I talk about the Miller-Jenkins case in the book. And what I say in the book is, I mean, they're having a child custody dispute. It's the answer isn't really constitutional law. I mean, basically what happened was that in that case, so Lisa is the biological mother of their child. Lisa wanted to end the relationship. She filed a suit to dissolve her civil union in a Vermont court. The Vermont court ordered visitation, and then Lisa switched attorneys, took the child to Virginia, and filed another suit in Virginia. What the last court in Virginia, the Court of Appeals, said was, this is controlled by a federal law called the Parental Kidnapping Prevention Act, which was designed for exactly this kind of situation. The reason Congress passed this law that said that once litigation is already underway in one state over child custody, no other state can consider the matter. And it had exactly this kind of situation in mind, because this happened a lot in child custody disputes with heterosexual couples. One parent would snatch the child, travel to another state, and file a new custody proceeding. So I think that the way to solve this is under existing law. You don't have to get into constitutional issues.
Now, talk to us a little bit, and just for listeners who may be just tuning in, we're talking to Andrew Koppelman, author of Same Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. And talk to us a little bit about evasive marriages, because that's an interesting term.
Okay, well, so what I've done is I've gone back and looked at the rules for when marriages have... This isn't the first time we've had a disagreement in the United States about which marriages should be recognized. And states have had restrictions on who their citizens could marry before. There have been disagreements about marriages between second cousins. There have been disagreements about what age you could marry at. And, of course, we talked about interracial marriage. The general rule is it depends on where did the couple make its home. The state where you live gets to decide who you can marry. And this means that there's a certain kind of case, which is the kind of case that everybody was focusing on during these debates about same-sex marriage, where the concern is, so you've got a couple in Salt Lake City, and they travel to Massachusetts for a day, get married, come right back to Utah again, and try to force Utah to recognize the marriage. And what all of the cases seem to say is that if you're trying to evade your home state's restrictions, your home state doesn't have to recognize that marriage. And so a lot of people, when they've said states don't have to recognize same-sex marriage, they have that kind of case in mind. But there are lots of other kinds of cases that are going to come up where a same-sex relationship is going to be relevant. So here, a couple of examples. So Utah says that it's not going to recognize same-sex marriage. Well, does that mean that somebody who's married in Massachusetts can run away to Utah and take all of the family assets with him, empty out the safe deposit box, empty out the bank account, and the family can't come after him for it? Or what happens when somebody from Massachusetts is hospitalized in Utah? Maybe just because they didn't mean to stay in Utah, they were just trying to drive through on the interstate. And the hospital needs to know who can make their medical decisions. Can somebody with a same-sex spouse in Massachusetts come to Utah and marry somebody else of the opposite sex without even disclosing to them that they have this spouse in Massachusetts? So it's insane for Utah to say that same-sex marriage has no effect in Utah. At least in some of those cases, people are being deprived of their property without due process, and that would be unconstitutional.
Now, speaking of unconstitutional, can you also go over for our audience why DOMA is probably unconstitutional?
Okay, DOMA is the Defense of Marriage Act, which was passed by Congress in 1996. And the Defense of Marriage Act does two things. First of all, it says that states don't have to recognize marriages from other states, which for the most part is like a congressional declaration that the sky is blue. I mean, that was already the law, so it doesn't have to do much change in that regard. The other thing, and the much more important thing that DOMA does, is it enacts a federal definition of marriage so that if you are in a same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, you're not trying to travel to any other state, you just live in Massachusetts, well, if you're a federal employee, you can't get health insurance for your spouse. If you die, you can't get Social Security benefits for your spouse. If you go into the Army and you go to Iraq and you're killed, your spouse can't get survivor's benefits. I've got a pretty long analysis of the Defense of Marriage Act, but in brief, there are a couple of other Supreme Court decisions that pretty squarely say if you subject gay people to treatment that's worse than anybody else has been subjected to in American history, just completely unprecedentedly harsh treatment, that's unconstitutional. I think that the Defense of Marriage Act is also an example of that.
And what has the response been to the Same-Sex, Different States book so far?
There are people who are unhappy about it on both sides of the political spectrum. There is a concern that you raised at the beginning. You know, you used to be in favor of same-sex marriage. Why are you conceding that these states can do this? To which I think my answer is, you're going to have this division in the United States. It's not going to go away. We need to think about how to live with it. And then there are people on the other side. The book was reviewed in the New York Post by somebody who was very opposed to same-sex marriage, who was very unhappy that I didn't talk about the terrible consequences of same-sex marriage. And aside from suggesting that they get over this idea of terrible consequences, which nobody's been able to show, I think I have the same answer. There are going to be these divisions, and people who are opposed to same-sex marriage say that they're concerned about children. Well, if they're concerned about children, they should be concerned if they are creating a legal regime that's going to encourage people to desert their families. They ought not to be happy about that.
Now, how can people get your book?
It's from Yale University Press. You can get it on the usual websites, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and at better bookstores.
Great. Well, I want to thank you very much, sir. We've been speaking with Andrew Koppelman, who's the author of Same Sex, Different States, When Same-Sex Marriages Cross State Lines. The book is currently available both online and off, and I highly recommend it. It definitely gives you a new perspective on an old argument. And, Andrew, I want to thank you so much for your time tonight.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to Queer Voices.
She plays with the boys, basketball and football are her favorite toys. She climbs up the trees and she skins her knees, but she built that treehouse with expertise. She looks so cute on her motorbike, but suddenly she's evil, people call her a dyke. Yeah, she's a dyke. Yike, she's a dyke. When I was younger, it was just a phase. They said I'd recover in a couple of days, but now that I'm older, I am sick and deranged. Oh, someone please tell me just exactly how I've changed. I mean, I'm still a dyke. I mean, I've always been a dyke. I don't know what the big deal is anymore. I'm just a dyke. Yike, I'm a dyke. Well, now look over there. It just isn't right. They're trying to take her baby in a custody fight. They say she's unfit. They want to put her away. They don't see her as a mother. They just see her as gay. Cause she's a dyke. Well, if you ask me, I think they're the mothers. She's just a dyke. Yike, she's a dyke. Piano solo, yeah. Well, I remember the day when push came to shove. They pushed us in the closet, told us who we could love, told us where we could go, told us what we could be. Now, isn't that ironic in this land of the free? Because we're dykes. Because we're dykes. Because we're dykes. Oh, look over there, Ethel. There's a whole bunch of them. Well, now the liberals are great. They say we're okay. As long as we stay hidden, keeping out of the way. But don't ever hold hands in a public place. Homophobics grab their children, shield them from this disgrace. They call us dykes. They do. They call us dykes. They call it dyke. Everybody now, here we go. Here dyke, there dyke, everywhere dyke. E-I-E-I-O. They call us dykes. They call us dyke. I don't know what they're calling us anymore, but we're dykes.
From the last century, from 1991, in fact, that was Lynn Thomas and her song, Dykes. This is Queer Voices.
And we have one of our favorite pundits here, Jeff Reed.
Yes,
and
Jeff. Welcome.
Hello, ladies.
Hello, ladies and the audience. There's more than ladies.
Yes.
And Glenn.
I was referring specifically to in the booth.
Yes.
It's just us ladies. But
right. Jeff tries to stay on top of things that are happening in the political world, and especially the fact that we have the Texas legislature in session, mm-hmm. which we try to do only every 2 years so that we're safer that way. But there's one bill having to do with stem cell research, and that's a great concern for all of us, no matter what our orientation.
Yes, exactly. So, specifically, House Bill 2704, it's been put forward by Representative Beverly Woolley here in Houston, and this is a bill that actually, she's a Republican, and it seems like it's a good idea. Basically, what it's going to do is it's going to protect stem cell research in Houston while at the same time banning human cloning. Now, there's a raft of bills that are up there now, and it's a little bit difficult to pick through it all because, of course, they're all saying things like, well, we want to ban human cloning, but that means several different things. Some bills, when they say ban human cloning, they are also meaning that they're going to ban embryonic stem cell research. Now, you'll recall that this is not legal in the U.S., if you're using federal funds. So the issue is, using private money, you can do stem cell research in Texas. You can do it in anywhere in the U.S., really. But because of the federal guidelines, you can't use federal facilities. Well, so that's another issue for the national level. But at the state level, if you can get private money and you can find a privately funded facility, you can actually do stem cell research in Texas. Well, these bills are coming up now that are trying to ban even that. Now, as you said, this is an important issue to everyone, but I think it's particularly important to the gay community because we have such a history with medical issues, with HIV/AIDS, and, you know, no one knows what will come out of the research. And by drawing sort of a thick line around a particular region of research and saying you can't go here, you have no idea what trajectories of research would travel through that and where they would land. So I as a scientist, by my day job, I hesitate to say by banning embryonic stem cell research, you're getting rid of a cure for diabetes, right? Because you can't really know that. But what you can certainly know is there is a huge law of unintended consequences where, this is a true story, a guy who was doing research into how lobsters see actually made one of the key discoveries that helped change microchips, because the way the lobster eye worked, it was actually very useful for focusing x-rays, which was essential for doing chip building.
That's interesting, because I was thinking, now why does anyone even care how a lobster sees?
Well, you know, the guy's a lobster biologist, and he likes nothing more in the world than to know about how lobsters work, and, you know, there are some people who are, you know, some crazy scientist out there is really going to care about that.
Or they can get funding for it.
And they can get funding for that. But yeah, so this is a key thing, and it is sort of a funny example, but it is a key thing for people to realize. It's not that you can say for any certainty that any given research is going to lead to something, or maybe by banning a particular kind of research, you're going to lose some result. But there are, the, you know, things follow a trajectory, and if you knew what trajectory it would follow, it wouldn't be new scientific research, right? I mean, for it to be new, you have to kind of follow where it takes you.
Well, there's already been some successes in what stem cells have been able to do and what they're working on. And I saw a presentation which really helped me understand some of the things that are involved. And one had to do with what they call mature stem cells and embryonic. And I think where the embryonic things come in is because of the abortion issue.
Right.
Although that's not where these stem cells come from. Embryonic stem cells can be used for almost any purpose in the body because they're unformed. They're babies. And,
right.
And the mature stem cells are ones that can only be used for a specific what they were originally destined for. And so using mature stem cells works for some things, but there's just this wealth of information that can be found in the use of embryonic stem cell research.
They are two very different animals, and it is true that there are adult stem cells, and this is something that the religious right tries to latch on to say, well, you know, why can't you just use the adult stem cells and not go to the embryonic stem cells? And the answer is, going back to that discussion about trajectories of research, obviously there are differences between embryonic stem cells and adult stem cells. If there weren't differences between them, the religious right wouldn't be willing to make a distinction between them, right? And those very distinctions are the things that maybe makes one more interesting than the other. And so by saying, well, you can do the thing with the adult but not with the embryonic, again, you're closing off a particular region of research, and you don't know what trajectories are going to need to, you know, what trajectories of research would need to move through there to get any given conclusion.
Well, another thing is that when you start thinking about stem cell, the rest of the world's going to be doing it anyway.
Well,
you know, we're just limiting the amount of study that we can do in the United States, and while the rest of the world moves on,
and elsewhere, they may not have the same ethical concerns that we
do. Right, and this is a great point, because MIT, right, the storied institution MIT, has built their first institution that is officially part of MIT, but which is not inside the U.S. And they are doing this in China, and they're spending an enormous amount of money. It's something like $400 million. And they're doing it specifically so they can do embryonic stem cell research, because over in China, there's nothing stopping them from that. Now, I think everyone agrees that one of the key engines of the next economic revolution is going to be biotechnology, and we may already be there. And, you know, by shutting off this really active venue of research, which is likely to produce a lot of interesting results and interesting innovations, we are almost certainly removing ourselves from the pool of competitive countries, companies, researchers, and, you know, when MIT is moving to China, you know there's a problem.
Now, this bill by Woolley, where is it? Is it in committee, or has it had a committee hearing?
So, to be honest, I don't know that. There was an article in the Chronicle earlier, I guess it was about a month ago, where they discussed the Woolley bill. My understanding is it's still in committee. It hasn't moved forward yet. And you know, this is, of the bills that are out there, this is the one that people are signing on to. There's an organization, although, you know, going by the name of an organization to see if you agree with them is not always the best thing to do, hence the Clean Air Act and things. But, you know, the Texans for the Advancement of Medical Research are on this, and the...
so they, you know, sound good on the surface.
They sound good on the surface, and the religious right doesn't like it, so, you know, it looks like it's a good bill, but... It's something to watch out for. This bill and the others that are out there, you know, there is going to be a fight in the legislature over stem cell research. And even though it seems like, well, it's already illegal, you know, it's actually not illegal. It's legal to do with local money, with non-federal funds, with local institutions, with private institutions, and actually, you know, a university that has a lab that's funded by some non-federal funding could actually do this research right now. If the laws changed to make this illegal in Texas, that avenue would be closed, and it would be even more restricted.
I just want to remind folks that if they want to check the status of bills, that they can go to the State of Texas website, and they can follow the links that will take them to what's going on in the legislature. Also, the Austin American Statement has a wonderful, they call it the virtual capital, and you can even get email alerts about what's really current and going on, what's been filed. I think the last filing date was in March, so
right.
Things are either in calendar, in committees, having hearings, different stages of the process, and then of course you can go to equalitytexas.org and for the GLPT.
And on this specific issue, the Texas Freedom Network, which is I believe it's a PAC, which was formed by I think it was Ann Richards' daughter.
Yes, Cecile Richards.
Yes, and they are really spearheading this, and they have a big sort of campaign to try to save science in Texas. So you can go just Google Texas Freedom Network, and you'll find some information there.
Now, Jeff Freed, before we close off, might we have a concern where it comes to stem cells and the idea of that someone would use this to change orientation?
Well, you know, sexual orientation, as a scientist but who is not expert in this field but has done some reading, I can say with as much certainty as I have about any of my understandings of science, sexual orientation is not wholly genetic. It is not wholly environmental. It is a combination of both. And it is not a simple genetic system. Obviously, if it was a simple genetic system where there was just a gene, there would be very few gay people because, you know, we don't really reproduce very often. Although maybe more recently. Seriously. But, But the point is,
we came from all those straight people.
Right. Like, we come from straight people. Knocking out is, let's say, in the simplest case, if there were a gay gene, if you could just knock it out, one, you don't know what unintended consequences that might have. So, you know, are you willing to trade a kid who's severely mentally retarded for a kid who isn't gay? I mean, that's one issue.
Right. Or someone who might be a Michelangelo.
Right.
Who would do the flower arrangement.
Exactly. And then the other issue is, I don't think you will ever find a single gene or a single switch that you can turn in a person to make them gay or not gay. There probably may eventually, 100, 200, 300 years from now, be an understanding where you could, let's say, change the situation where you would make it more likely or less likely. But, you know, dabbling at that level in people, we haven't done it yet. There's an enormous amount of research that would have to happen before we could do it. And the consequences, the side effects, I think, would be huge.
And personally, I think be hugely unethical.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That is not a real issue of concern.
Well,
right
thanks
now.
For being with us here on Queer Voices. It is KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM. We appreciate you listening to Queer Voices. And up next, we're going to be talking with Rose Wall. She's the volunteer coordinator for the Transgender Unity Banquet. And she's going to talk to Jennifer Renee about this year's event. And as we transition here.
Right, well, musical chairs
the
here.
The lovely Jeff for the lovely Rose.
Good night. Hey, Rose, welcome. This is Rose Wall, and she's volunteer coordinator with this year's Houston Transgender Unity Banquet, which is held this Saturday. And Rose, tell us about it. Give us some more information about it. It's going to be this Saturday. What else do they need to know? Isn't there a reception on Friday night?
Yes, there's a reception for a lot of the sponsors and various people who are involved in the transgender community to get together and network and maybe come up with some ideas in which, you know, we can do things together. One of the big things that we've been trying to do over the years is to get more involved in the GLBT community and actually spread out into all the various areas. So we have a lot of sponsors, corporate sponsors, all sorts of different sponsors, and if we can all network together to help each other, then everything improves.
Now, for the banquet and all, there's the food and the entertainment and all. Where does the money go? After everything's paid for, what do you do with the money?
Okay, it goes to help fund some of the various things that we do the rest of the year. Two major things that we're involved with is that we always put a float in the parade, again, to raise transgender awareness, and also the Day of Remembrance that occurs in November, I believe, each year. That is to basically celebrate the lives that have been lost in the previous year. These are transgendered individuals who have died during that time, typically due to violent circumstances, and just being who they are, and, you know, people just kill them, you know, basically. And so it's a national thing that's done across the United States and a lot of various organizations, and we handle the life celebration here in the city of Houston.
Now, going back to the banquet, though, mm-hmm. This is which one? What year? This is the 15th?
Yes,
15th annual?
It's the 15th annual transgender banquet. It was started about 15 years ago. And one of the things that we've done in the past few years is we've started a scholarship fund. And when proud to say it's our second consecutive year of giving out a scholarship, and that's also where some of that extra money goes. But the name of the scholarship is the Peggy Rudd Scholarship, and she was one of the original founders of the Houston Transgender Unity Committee, or what eventually became HW.
And she's a prolific writer about transgender and yes. The people cross-dressing, everyone chronicling a lot of the transgender community over the last 10 or 15 years, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's why it was named after her. Also, you said this was the second year. Now, the scholarship goes to transgendered individuals?
Yes, that's correct. We open it up to transgender individuals who fill out applications. We have a committee review, and the final selections are made. At this point, we've been able to give basically about $1,000 each year to transgendered individuals for scholarship funds.
Now, this year, as far as the time is concerned, where is the banquet and what time is it?
Mm-hmm. Okay, it's actually going to be at the West Chase Hilton in the Omni Ballroom. And double check that. Yeah, the meet and greet starts at 6:30. There will be a cash bar if you want to buy drinks and stuff. But for about the first hour, everyone's going to be kind of mingling and getting to know each other. There's a lot of,
people seeing each other they haven't seen for a long time. Yeah. Obviously, I go every year, and it's always nice to see the people you haven't seen for a year, because people come in from all over the state and all over the country to this event. Reading the history of the Unity Banquet is that it's one of the largest banquets of its kind for the transgender community in the United States, and the most successful over the years. Of course, it started humbly enough 15 years ago, but it's great for this. Now, who's going to be speaking this year?
Our primary speaker this year is going to be Ray Hill. We're very proud to have him speak. He's, of course, basically, we consider him the founder and father of the GLBT community and
the godfather.
Yes, the godfather, here in Houston. And we're very proud to have him come and speak to us this year.
Well, I know that in the past, you've had a number of different speakers from all over the country. And what prompted this year's decision to ask Ray? I don't know the answer to that,
I
do
don't
you?
Know
I stumped her, didn't I?
You got me.
That's okay. No, one of the reasons was, since I was on that committee to pick the speaker, was that one of the things we try to do is bring a speaker to the banquet who has been instrumental within the GLBT community, the transgender community, but also the GLBT community, because over the last 3 years, the Unity Banquet, which was founded by the Unity Committee, to bring together all the transgendered organizations who used to go helter-skelter different ways for cross purposes sometimes, to all work together and to speak within Houston anyway as one unified voice. And over the last 3 years especially, that has expanded to the GLB community, also with many of the sponsors for the banquet being from the GLB community. Several come to mind. The HRC is a sponsor, as well as other traditionally gay and lesbian organizations that now sponsor the Transgendered Unity Banquet. And in doing so, we felt like this year we would get someone who could speak to the entire community, who not only was part of the transgender community as far as working with it, but someone who spoke for the GLB community for many years. All right, that's the answer to your question.
Okay.
To my question to you.
Sometimes.
Okay. It's sort of being rhetorical.
Yeah,
I got to be free.
Rose, I have a question about, you give awards each year.
Yes.
And who are the award recipients for this year? You have that.
The actual.
Is that being held secret?
It's sort of like the Oscars,
yeah.
You know.
Oh.
I bet you didn't know. I'm emceeing this year.
Oh,
and
my.
Yes, I know. I get to be up there and make a bigger fool of myself than I do here on the radio. But
you'll look glamorous doing it.
I will look good at
will.
It. You've got to come. You'll get to see me live. But one of the things is that they're announced at the time of the banquet.
Yes, and
that's not the way it was done last year, but there was a reason for that obviously I have forgotten.
Well, whatever it is. This year it's that way.
Okay.
We do go to great pains behind the scenes to make certain that all the award winners will be present.
Yeah, otherwise it'd be quite awkward.
Yeah, we don't exactly tell them the exact reason why. We just say, you're coming this year. You know,
okay.
And they'll say, well, you know, I'm going to do my nails or something. Say, you're coming this year. I will drive and pick you up.
Uh-huh.
You're coming. Okay.
Send the limo.
And one of the awards winners, I'm certain, will be there.
Well, other than Ray Hill, who is, you know, quite entertaining by all means, is there other entertainment or activities going on?
Well, following the event, we have a... you know, we like to get out there and put our dancing shoes on.
Oh, yeah.
So there will be a DJ, and there will be a dance floor, and that'll occur at the end after Ray's thing. But, of course, we will also be giving out the scholarship, so the scholarship recipient will be there so that we can present that to that person and present that individual, you know, to the community and say, this is someone that we're all pulling together to support.
Now, what about the other groups within that make up the transgendered community?
Right.
What's happening with them this year?
What we're doing this year is we're trying to... there are so many different groups that a lot of times we lose track of them because they actually change their names during the year. And what we're trying to do is we're actually trying to educate ourselves on everyone who's out there and what they're doing. So each one of the organizations who make up the Houston Transgender Unity Committee are going to be speaking, and they'll all get up and a representative will kind of give a 2-minute spiel on what they're about and when their meetings are and why they exist and everything. And what's interesting about that is that originally when this started, it was basically two organizations that got together originally. An organization I used to be a former president of, the GCTC with Renee Finner, and of course Peggy Rudd is the one who started it, and with help from Renee Finner, they put on the first one.
What did those initials stand for?
GCTC stands for Gulf Coast Transgender Community, and Peggy Rudd was representing the Tau Chi chapter of Tri-S.
And Tri-S is...
I don't remember exactly what Tri-S stands for.
Tri-S, well, it's the community of for the second self. That's what it is, and it's just that was just the sort of like your fraternities and sororities that had, you know, whatever the Greek letter were. That was what it is. They basically, it's representing the cross-dressers and their families,
and their
wives, and their children are all part of that organization. Yes,
right. And one of the important things that you alluded to earlier is the fact that we're kind of unique in the United States in the fact that we have finally pulled together every transgender organization, you know, that we could possibly find in the greater Houston area to bring them in to this community and under the HTOC umbrella so that we can all work together. Like you alluded to, a lot of times in the past we would be at cross purposes and
they would cross dress and be at cross purposes.
It was so confusing.
It was, and
I think what you found out was that you had many more things in common than differences, and that you were stronger, thus the term unity.
Right, and I think that's one of the reasons why a lot of the local GL organizations are now GLBT is primarily because of the work that we did. We actually showed that we are viable members of the community and that we have something to bring to the table and everything.
Well, before we close off, the important information, tickets are still available.
And you can get tickets from where?
At this point, the best place to get tickets from would be from Jules here in the Montrose area. And of course, we will have tickets for sale at the door. We have now closed down our ticket web.
So Jules is at Fairview and Taft.
Yes.
And a little shop there. You can buy some stuff besides tickets while you're there.
Oh, she is. She has fabulous outfits.
Yeah, there you go. An endorsement.
I saw a few there.
Yeah.
Myself.
So, Rose Wall with the Transgender Unity Banquet, thanks for being with us on Queer Voices.
Thank you.
And Tret Fury, an album called Postcards from Paradise. This is Queer Voices.
More especially, that was Tret Fury, that she was the writer of that song, and she will be performing here in Houston on Thursday, April 9th at Anderson Fair as part of a singer-songwriter in the round. I think the show starts around 9 p.m. over at Anderson Fair, the notorious, wonderful, and an important Anderson Fair, a longtime Houston institution, and she'll be in LaGrange at the Bugle Boy on Saturday. And if you want to find out more about that, just Google the Bugle Boy, and you'll. They have lots of great folks out there.
We have someone in the studio.
We do. Thank you for bringing that to my attention.
Just thought I'd mention.
We have Brian Riddle.
We only have four chairs in here.
Brian Riddle, Ph.D., and he's the Education Program Coordinator with the Montrose Counseling Center. And he has the delightful task of discussing sexually transmitted infections because April is STD Awareness Month. And I guess if you have one, you usually are pretty aware of it.
I was going to say that.
Surprisingly, sometimes you're not. And that's why we need to talk about it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
There are some STDs that actually don't show symptoms for a long time until you really need to get them treated. So that's why we have an awareness month to bring it to people's attention.
So that means you can have it and you can be transmitting it.
Exactly. Case in point, HIV. Absolutely no symptoms for a long period of time, sexually transmitted, and you can be giving it to people for 10, 8 years before you develop any symptoms yourself.
Now, of course, that's the most dramatic one, the most life-threatening or life-changing one. And other ones may be an indication of HIV infection also being part of the problem there. Because if you have one sexually transmitted disease, that means you're probably using unprotected sex.
More than likely. And it's absolutely right, Deborah. You're pointing to one of the big connections that we try as a field to get people to pay attention to, is that usually, if you are exposed to HIV, you've probably also been exposed to some other form of sexually transmitted infection.
Is HIV often tested for when someone comes in with a sexually transmitted disease? They're really there because they're itching or they're swelling or there's something else going on, and they go to get that checked out, and somebody says, have you had an HIV test? And they say no. And
Well, actually, often enough, what happens with HIV is that people either get tested on a regular basis or they get sick for some other reason that they can't explain, not just an itching, but like they're fatigued, their lymph nodes swell or something like that. I think what's really actually important to say on a day like today, for a month like this month, is that we do spend a lot of time paying attention to things like HIV and perhaps not enough time paying attention to the other infections that we ought to.
What should we be looking for? What is it? What should we be aware of that we're missing?
Well, first of all, there are a whole bunch of them that can go undetected for a long time. For example, hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is very rarely sexually transmitted, but it can be. Again, a long period of time with no visible symptoms. Getting tested for that is a good idea. But honestly, most of the sexually transmitted infections give you some kind of warning sign at some point, like gonorrhea, like chlamydia, like even trichomoniasis. So what I think would be really most important to tell people is pay attention to your body. You'll know when something is not right. You'll know when something, like you say, itches. You'll know when something smells different than it should, has a different color than it should.
An emission.
Right. Or if you have trouble urinating, these are also signs of sexually transmitted infections.
Come in before it falls off, right?
Yeah, because you really... See, the thing is, sex is good. Sex is a great thing, and we can't emphasize that enough, especially in an atmosphere where a lot of people feel that abstinence-only education is the right way to talk to people about sexually transmitted infections. We know that for some people it does work, but for most people, it's really not their first choice. So what we want to do is make sure that, first of all, people feel comfortable talking to their partners about sexually transmitted infections so they can prevent spreading it in the first place. It's very, very possible to have a fantastic sex life, have a sexually transmissible infection, and not give it to someone through use of barriers, through use of proper sexual practices.
So, once again, that safer sex that we... You know, back in the day, when I was a sweet young thing,
you still are.
I know, you're right. The concern of an unintended pregnancy was there, so often protection was used for that. If the birth control pill came along, and that changed a lot of things.
Absolutely,
sometimes protection wasn't always being used, such as a prophylactic. there were, oh, you get something, you go get a shot, and it's
right.
gone.
Right.
What's out there now, and what are some, I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the news about the human papillomavirus.
Absolutely.
Which is the same, it's one or two of the HPV viruses.
Mm-hmm.
Can cause genital warts, but mm-hmm. not all of them cause genital warts.
Absolutely.
And the ones that do are not necessarily the ones that can cause the infection that can lead to cervical cancer.
Mm-hmm.
But they like to hang out together.
They do.
You know, with their homies. What happens when there's a disease, it is an environment is created that welcomes more infection.
Absolutely true. And to Governor Perry's great credit, he did take advantage of his bully pulpit to make it a public issue, regardless of whether or not he's able to make something happen on the ground. He's made people talk about HPV so that people know that the human papillomavirus now causes genital warts and that there's a connection to cervical cancer. A lot of people have paid attention to the effects for young women, but they haven't actually paid attention to the effects that men can get too, because it takes kind of multiple people to tango. HPV travels between people. It's not just something that spontaneously appears on young girls. It needs to be transmitted from partner to partner. And a lot of times for those young women, that partner is a young man. And it may be in any number of kind of combinations of bodies. That's something that some of our sexual transmission infection education is now beginning to be able to realize, to talk about how to say things that include transgender bodies, include intersex bodies, so that you're not always constantly saying, well, on a man it looks like this, and on a woman it looks like this. And that's something actually that Perry's conversation didn't ever really get around to. Gay men were absolutely excluded from that possibility, especially when we know that the human papillomavirus can cause penile and anal cancers.
Mm-hmm.
So that same vaccine that's been approved for use in young girls ought also to be considered by sexually active men, because it can helpfully prevent future cancers.
There you go.
I did not know that.
Now
that
you know.
I know. Yeah. I'm glad it's... Yeah, I guess that's why it's April Awareness.
I'm aware now.
Yeah, I thought, too, that Governor Perry, as much as we dislike him and so many other things, was doing a good thing, but maybe went about it in the wrong way.
Well, every person is capable of a moment of brilliance, unintended or intended.
And so what if he just happened to get a donation from the manufacturer? Talking about sexually transmitted diseases, you almost don't really hear much about it anymore because mm-hmm. of the HIV. Everyone focuses on that, and they're not talking about some of the other risks that may involve. Now, are all sexually transmitted diseases viruses?
Absolutely not. And actually, that's one of the reasons that we like to kind of change the language away from diseases toward infections. Because a large number of these can be cured with antibiotics. There's a lot of bacterial and protozoan infections that can just be wiped out with a small dose of medicine. But viral, unfortunately, there's really not a cure. Either your body can clear it, or you're with it for life.
What kind of statistics are we looking at as far as, you know, what's out there and what's so prevalent? You know, obviously in our community we talk about HIV all
Absolutely.
The time. But, you know, that's statistically there's got to be something number two and number three.
Actually, there's something number one in occurrence above HIV in
oh,
America.
Oh, my God, what is it?
Hepatitis C.
Really?
Hepatitis okay. C. There are over 4 million people in the United States who are infected with hepatitis C. About 3.8 of those with the chronic, that is, the version that doesn't go away. Your body doesn't clear it.
That doesn't necessarily mean they were infected sexually.
Exactly. A vast majority of people infected with hepatitis C got it through direct blood-to-blood transmission, usually through needle use, tattoos, intravenous drugs, those sorts of things.
Wow.
Very rarely through sex. Now, in comparison, that's 4 million people, remember. HIV, estimated around about 1 million people, a little over 1 million people living with HIV in the United States today. A huge number, but still 1/4 of that who are carrying hepatitis C.
Okay, what's number three?
Honestly, I don't know the ranking of all of them,
okay,
but there's some interesting
numbers.
Hepatitis B ranks right up there with HIV in terms of occurrence. Now, here's the thing about hepatitis B. Some people can clear it. For some people, it's just acute. They get it once, and it goes away. Once you've got it, and cleared it, you're done with it. But a lot of people, if they get it, it's chronic. A good number of people, and it sticks with them for a long time. Now, hepatitis B feels like maybe the first time you get it, the flu, but it can stick around for a long time.
Mm. And then if you have it, you could transmit.
You absolutely can transmit it, and it is transmitted sexually through blood, through semen, pre-cum, vaginal fluids. Those are the main fluids of transmission for hepatitis B.
Now, hepatitis A, that's the one that's the acute form.
Yeah, that's only acute. That's,
right.
That means that you get it once and you're done with it. Now, most people hear that in context of, like, Papacitos recently.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people...
The marble slab out in Cape.
Yeah, there's lots of... People call it restaurant hepatitis a lot because you get it pretty much because someone was in a rush and they forgot to wash their hands after the bathroom while they were making your food, and voila, instant contact. The route of transmission, oral, fecal. So it's often called restaurant hepatitis, but it can also be sexually transmitted, especially if you're engaging in practices that would bring your mouth near any kind of fecal matter, even the slightest amount.
Hmm.
So that's one of the reasons why when people want to do things like oral vaginal sex, oral anal sex, anything around that area, a barrier of some kind is a great idea. And you don't have to go to a condom shop and spend a lot of money on a dental dam. You can just get that big old patch of saran wrap, as Nancy Ford is fond of saying
oh,
in her
yes.
song, The Scratch on the Snatch.
Yes.
There you go.
Oh,
that's
yeah.
great. Okay.
And it doesn't matter if it's the microwavable kind
actually,
or not.
And you can get colors in it, too.
Well, now, when I was doing outreach,
uh-huh.
they said it didn't matter. But
research has shown that microwavable saran wrap, plastic wrap, has sufficient pores in it for HIV, hepatitis, a lot of these viruses to slip through. And then there's the other thing about the colored kind. Yeah, you can get it, but you're going to look like a Christmas treat with a
yeah.
red face or a green face. Or
oh,
your partner.
That could be fun.
Yeah,
you can also use an unlubricated condom and cut it open.
Absolutely. I mean, having a pair of scissors by your bed or in your nightstand or in your glove compartment to slice open that condom in a pinch, it's a natch.
Oh,
you can do it.
Oh, she had those scissors there.
There you go. See, it's not just for trimming nails.
Well, this is awareness.
It is. It is.
Brian Riddle from the Montrose Counseling Center, you certainly have educated us tonight on
Happy
Queer
to do
Voices.
It.
And it seems like we have a whole lot more that we could talk about, so we invite you back in the future.
Please do. Come back.
I'd be happy to.
And we'll be back in just a moment with the rest of This Way Out.
Ten years ago this month, the much-anticipated arrival of a certain puppy was a milestone for U.S. Network Television. The hour-long episode that brought Ellen DeGeneres' sitcom persona out of the closet went where no lead character had gone before. Before there was a Will and Grace, before almost every major show had at least explored homosexuality in one way or another, and way before the advent of LGBT-targeted cable channels. In honor of the anniversary of Ellen's landmark broadcast, we take a look back at how This Way Out's Greg Gordon and our correspondents reported on the occasion a decade ago.
From the hype in Hollywood to the bigotry in Birmingham, the coming-out story of comic Ellen DeGeneres and her TV sitcom character Ellen Morgan captured headlines and became a rallying cry for the gay and lesbian community for months. All the high-profile press focused on Ellen also inspired opposition forces, but only one ABC TV network affiliate in Birmingham, Alabama, refused to carry the show. This Way Out will take you to that city where the community came out with Ellen anyway. We'll also go to GLAAD's West Hollywood Gala, and of course we'll hear highlights from the program that caused all the fuss. The long saga that began with a September press leak reached its climax on April 30th when the one-hour special, codenamed The Puppy Episode, was finally broadcast. Hours before The Puppy aired, DeGeneres appeared on Oprah Winfrey's daytime talk show.
Well... You nervous or what?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
A little bit?
Everybody thinks I'm a freak.
Cover of Time magazine. Did you expect that? Did you expect it to turn into all of this?
No. No. I mean, I knew that it would be big, but I had no idea that it would be this big. And I didn't know it was going to drag out for so long either. So I understand the frustration, but it just was something that I decided and wanted to do and thought it would be wonderful for me. And as a result...
So did you decide for the character first, that you wanted the character to give the character some kind of Or did you decide for yourself first?
I decided for me first. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, because I never thought it was anybody's business, mm-hmm. who I am and who I am with. And so I thought, why do people need to know? Mm-hmm. And then I realized that as long as I had this secret that I worried about all the time, that it made it look like something was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I decided that it was time for me to say, I'm fine with who I am, I feel good about me, I'm not ashamed of who I am, I thought, really, who cares still about me? If I can do something creatively, if I can actually show people that it is okay in another way, and I have this wonderful way to do it, mm-hmm. why not do it that way?
There's a perception, and I've been trying to fight this for years on TV, that gay people are just swinging from the chandeliers, having sex all the time, and that they're all marching in the Mardi Gras parade with feathers and boas,
mm-hmm.
and that they don't understand that, to the greatest extent, gay people want the same thing everybody else wants.
Yes, and I think that there are probably a lot of heterosexual people that swing from chandeliers and mm-hmm. have sex all the time, and, you know,
I would say probably more.
Yeah.
But I
think that's why this is such a big deal, and I think that's why people like Falwell and people are having such a hard time with it. And I just am saying, and I'm not trying to change anybody's opinion on anything other than to say that I'm fine with who I am now. And for a long time, I wasn't. And I understand the fear, and but I'm okay. I have to say, before the show ends, that Birmingham, Alabama is the only affiliate that would not air the show. And I just got information that someone there got, people got an auditorium together and they sold 2,100 seats in 8 hours to air the program in the auditorium. And the only thing that sells that fast in Birmingham are tractor pulls and mud wrestling.
Once again, Alabama has become the central turf in another chapter of the civil rights movement in the United States. I'm John McMullen for This Way Out. 22 years after Rosa Parks refused to sit in the back of a Montgomery City bus because of the color of her skin, gay and lesbian activists in Birmingham stood up in the face of homophobia, overcoming the local ABC network affiliate's decision not to broadcast the coming out episode of Ellen. Birmingham Pride Alabama, the organization that plans and produces the local Pride Festival, rented the city's Boutwell Auditorium, where 2,500 people packed in to watch the show on a large-screen television from a satellite feed out of New York. WBMA, known as ABC 3340 in Birmingham, set off the explosion that brought the attention of people all across the nation to this community. The station manager said that he felt the episode was inappropriate for family hour viewing, but polls showed that public opinion was not overwhelmingly in favor of the action, which many called censorship. Don McDaniel of Birmingham was one of those who didn't like the idea of being told what she could or couldn't watch on her own television.
I was furious, and I did all I could to try to get the show aired. I called everyone I could.
Others, like Kathy Ballou, were quick to emphasize that it was ABC 3340 that should take the heat, not the people of Alabama.
I believe this was definitely a decision made by one or two people, and I don't believe that it reflects the entire community's backwards attitude, and I think that that is well served by the turnout that we're seeing here tonight.
There was no sign of protesters. Birmingham police made two sweeps through the auditorium with bomb-sniffing dogs, but nothing was detected, and no threatening calls were received prior to or during the event. The only sign of any protest were two men who peacefully handed out Christian literature in front of the facility. With more than 20 news agencies, including major television networks, in attendance, the Birmingham event relied on support from the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation. Kathy Renna from GLAAD's Washington, D.C. Media Resource Center expressed her own surprise at the event.
I'm beyond moved by the people that have come here. Entertainment Tonight interviewed me and asked if there are any celebrities, and I said every person in this stadium tonight is a celebrity.
Kevin Snow, vice president of Birmingham Pride Alabama and one of the organizers of the Welcome Out Ellen Party, addressed the packed auditorium just prior to the start of the show.
More than any other medium, television has the opportunity to present us with a portrait of the American family as it really is, in all our diversity. No more will gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and transgender persons be cropped out of the picture. Ladies and gentlemen, Ellen!
Ellen, you're going to be late for your dinner date with your old college friend, Richard.
I can't believe it.
What, that Ellen has a date?
No, that she went to college. But she's been in there forever.
Ellen, are you coming out or not?
Yeah, Ellen, quit jerking us around and come out already.
What is the big deal? I've got a whole hour.
As you'll hear in the following excerpts, Ellen progresses from denial to self-acceptance during the hour with the help of her therapist, played by Oprah Winfrey. Her date with Richard is a bust, but she does meet his co-worker, Susan, played by Laura Dern.
I don't date men. Oh. Why? I'm gay. You're gay?
Yeah.
Oh. How about that? Gay. Good. Good. Gay. I didn't. That's good for you. Of course. Why wouldn't you be gay?
Wow. I thought you knew.
No. Didn't know.
Yeah. In fact, I thought you were gay, too.
You thought I was gay?
Yeah.
Why would you... Why would you think I was gay?
Oh, wow. I'm sorry. I just kind of got that vibe.
Vibe? Like a gay vibe? You know, like... What, like I'm giving off some kind of gay vibration, you know? Gay! Yeah. I think I know what's going on. It's not enough for you to be gay. You know, you've got to recruit others, you know?
Hey, I'll have to call national headquarters and tell them I lost you. Damn, just one more and I would have gotten that toaster oven.
What is that, gay humor? Because I don't get it.
So you didn't sleep with him?
Not even close. But I lied to my friends and I told them I did.
So it's easier to tell your friends what they want to hear.
Finally, a therapist I can work with. And it's not like I'm looking for perfection, you know. I just want somebody special. Somebody, you know, that I click with.
And obviously you didn't click with Richard. Has there ever been anyone you felt you clicked with? And what was his name?
Susan.
Can I talk to you just quickly before you leave?
Please
let me just talk. Just
okay.
You know how you know you said in the room, you know, that you thought maybe I was, you know, I said no. Well, I was thinking about it, you know, and I think that maybe I'm I am I guess what I'm trying to say is I did get the joke about the toaster oven.
Saying what I think you're trying to say?
What do you think I'm trying to say?
Oh, I'm not going to say it again and be wrong.
No, you're not wrong. You're right. This is so hard, but I think I've realized that I am... I can't even say the word. Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say... I mean, what is wrong? Why do I have to be so ashamed? I mean, why can't I just say the truth? I mean, be who I am. I'm 35 years old. I'm so afraid to tell people. I mean, I just... Susan, I'm gay.
I still can't believe that Ellen is gay.
Well, I always thought for a while she might be. I mean, even as a kid, she could throw football farther than me, you know? Climb a tree faster, always beat me in arm wrestling. Did you ever think maybe you were gay?
So, Ellen, what do you think of little Frida?
It's cute. I haven't been here before.
Surprise! It's a lesbian coffee house.
You've been living in our world. Now we want to experience your world.
Since when did my world become a lesbian coffee house?
Hi.
I'm Janine. Listen, Janine, hi. I just realized I'm gay, so I'm not really ready to start dating or anything.
No, good for you. I'm your waitress.
So, you know, even though this whole thing with Susan was kind of heartbreaking, I feel like this tremendous weight has been lifted off of me, you know? I mean, for the first time in my life, I feel comfortable with myself.
Ellen, that is wonderful.
Yeah. So, I guess I'm not going to need you anymore. But thank you so much for everything. And take care, huh?
Ellen, when do you think you'll be ready to start dating again?
You're just trying to make more money, aren't you?
Here she is.
Okay, Miss Morgan, I have just one question for you. Are you gay? Yes, yes, I am. I'm standing right there. And Lisa here. And Lisa here.
Oh.
And sign here.
Wow, I didn't know it was so complicated.
Congratulations.
Susan.
There's a question.
Oh, thank you so much.
Entertainment Tonight for Thursday, May 1st, 1997. Hi, everybody. I'm Bob Goen.
And I'm Mary Hart.
Reaction to Ellen's coming out episode varied widely across the country, but it was strong.
He didn't know that it was going to sort of take over the world.
I love her very much, and I support her.
I think people are glorifying a situation that's a sin.
You're gay. So what are you going to do now?
I'm going to Disneyland.
ABC estimates 42 million people watched the landmark show, making it the highest-rated sitcom this season on any network. Preliminary overnight ratings have Ellen demolishing her competition. Jane Seymour's CBS TV movie, Jim Carrey's Ace Ventura on NBC, and Joan Collins' debut on Pacific Palisades on Fox.
It was just an incredible sweep, and I'm sure the folks at ABC are dancing in the aisle.
Anticipated coming out episode of Ellen was celebrated with parties and gatherings all across the United States. I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Chris Wilson. Here in West Hollywood, hundreds turned out for a special evening hosted by GLAAD, the Gay and Lesbian Alliance Against Defamation.
Among those celebrating the historic event were many of the Ellen cast members. Patrick Bristow, who plays the openly gay character Evan, attended the event with his off-screen life partner and described what it was like when the episode was filmed.
I was trembling. It was so exciting to feel that support from the audience and the crew and everyone. It was truly one of those great moments that you'll never forget. And for Ellen, I cannot even imagine what it felt like for her.
Not surprisingly, the audience reaction to the show was overwhelmingly positive.
I think this was a moment in history, and I wanted to be here with everybody to witness it together. I just thought it was a celebration.
I know Ellen likes to say she's not very political, but coming out has always been a political act.
Well, we're here because our daughter is here, and we're involved with PFLAG.
I think people buy what's on television. And I think America will buy this. I think it will happen. I think it will work, and it will become okay. And if it only changes something for the gay and lesbian youth out there who will watch it, that's really what's important anyway.
It remains to be seen whether or not the boost in ratings from the coming out episode will continue as a lasting trend for the Ellen show. No matter what the future holds, however, history was made on this last day of April, 1997. Reporting from West Hollywood, I'm Pam Marshall.
And I'm Chris Wilson.
Ellen finished strong for the next few weeks, but dwindling ratings led to the show's cancellation the following season. Many critics complained that the officially lesbian Ellen had become too preachy. DeGeneres returned to TV in 2001 with another out comedy series that was unfortunately short-lived. She went on to host numerous award shows, most notably the 9/11 postponed 2001 Primetime Emmys and this year's Oscars, and to find her niche as the star of a highly successful award-winning daytime talk show. Many critics now complain that the new Ellen isn't preachy enough, but she is still honored for the role she played in setting a new standard for queer visibility in the mainstream media. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. This week, Rick Watts, Sherry Lunn, Rex Walkner with Bill Kelly, and Graham Underhill contributed program material. Thanks also to John McMullen and Chris Wilson and Pam Marshall. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen online to This Way Out anytime, exclusively at outinamerica.com. You can also click on the link at the top of our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are underwritten by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from listeners like you. Thank you. Please log on to thiswayout.org to see how you can help keep this program on the air. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening on Free Radio San Diego, San Diego, California, 4CCR Cairns, Queensland, Grateful Dread Radio, Baltimore, Maryland, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now, y'all stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. Now, you have to understand that I asked Deborah if she wanted a little more time to croak and moan before the end of the show. And asking Deborah if she wants time to talk is like asking the sun if it wants to rise in the morning.
It's who I am.
She's going to shine now.
Yes.
Deborah Bell.
I feel the love. Well, Brian Riddle from the Montrose Counseling Center is going to give information on where you can go to get tested for STDs.
Thank you, Deborah and Jennifer. There are lots of places to get tested, but there are five different kind of organizations that you should know about. There is always free HIV testing available through the Montrose Counseling Center, currently located at 701 Richmond in Houston. You can call 713-529-0037 and ask for outreach. Testing is also available free and at low cost at Legacy Community Health Services, located at 215 Westheimer. You may also call the City of Houston. Their main line for testing services is 713-794-9092. Baylor Teen Clinic specializes in 21 and under only free testing. They have locations all over Houston, and you can call 713-873-3601. And Planned Parenthood also has various clinics throughout Houston at a sliding scale for a full battery of tests. You may call their 1-800 number 230-PLAN for your local clinic.
A shrink with a sultry voice.
Yeah, it's an
you gotta love it. Gotta love it.
Jennifer, you wanted to make sure that folks knew about an event happening on Thursday.
Yes, the Houston GLBT Political Caucus is having a reception on Thursday, 7 to 9. Melissa Noriega, the candidate for city council that the caucus pact endorsed, will be speaking. It's for her. It's at Hollywood Chinese there on Montrose, right near Fairview. So please come out and be part of the event.
All right. And we want to thank all our guests tonight, certainly Brian from the Montrose Counseling Center, Rose Wall, volunteer coordinator for the Transgender Unity Banquet coming up this Saturday, our pundit Jeff Reed, Andy Koppelman talking with Joan Devlin about his book, and Aaron Coleman with his wonderful melodious voice sharing his poetry in the event April 13th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Baring and James 805 Road Place.
Yes, and don't forget about next week. Please come back and join us, Rodney Waters, about the concert on April 28th as part of the celebration of the Resurrection Metropolitan Community Church's 35th anniversary, a Martine Locke interview with J.D. Doyle, Diva House concert, April 21st at Mojo Rising.
And Stagis, Houston premiere of Doug Wright's 2004 Tony and Pulitzer Prize winner, I Am My Own Wife. At Stagis, starring Philip Lille, It opened Friday at Stages, and it chronicles the life of Charlotte Van Malsdorf, who an East German transvestite who survived two of the most oppressive regimes in history, the Nazis and the Communists.
Bless her heart.
Yeah, that sounds like it's just going to be an incredible performance. And it's a solo performance, but the actor plays more than one character.
It was an interesting article in Sunday's paper about it.
Right.
Chronicling, well, not the
Everett
supplement.
Evans told the story, the backstory behind this true life event, as they always say, based on a true story.
Yes, the rest of the story.
Yes, and of course, we appreciate you listening to Queer Voices and being with us every week. We are on Mondays from 8 to 10, and you can tune in on the web at www.kpft.org. You can also download songs, or songs. You can download songs.
You can download songs, too, but you can download the show. Yes.
And listen to them in perpetuity.
Absolutely.
From the website in the archives. And don't contact me to ask me the details about how you do it, because I don't know.
Oh, it's real simple. It has a little spot. It says listen or download. Click download.
Yes. Well, I've done it. I know how to do it, but I don't know how to tell anyone else how to do it.
Unless they've straightened it out, if you push download, you'll listen to it. You actually push listen to download it. Now, don't ask me why they do that
way. I think we thoroughly confused them, Jennifer.
Oh. Well, then what you should do is listen live every week between 8 and 10. Come back and enjoy us. Enjoy us. I love it.
Yes, enjoy
us. Please enjoy us next week.
Okay. And on behalf of
Jennifer Renee,
Deborah Bell,
and Glenn Holt,
thank you for listening. Stay tuned for World Village Cafe.
So my brother says God is a flat-butted, crude-cutting linebacker, a macho babe hijacker, panting at the line of scrimmage. He makes God in his own image, and I don't begrudge him that. But his is a God who hates all fads, Jews, Hindus, and kids in rags. The Bible can thump like a big bass drum, till every single sacred cow comes home. I know where that's at. God is why. God is why. God is why. You can't get around to the other side. You can't have a run around. Shock can I? So my brother says, say what you will, and I don't really care what you do. It's your life and it's up to you. But then he blinks his eye, which is true sky blue. Puts his arm around his daughter, turns to view the two. Jumps and cheers when his team rocks. Then there's the God with open eyes. He's the God of the family farms. Inhabits the fields and the flowers and the barns. Smiles when the missus darns, her husband sighs. God is why. God is why. God is why. You can't get around to the other side. You can't have a remedy. Shock can't hide. So my brother says, you know that I don't like to fight, but I think I know what's wrong or what's right. Whatever some people may do or say, you can't tell me it's okay. It ain't no way to be. And there's the God who lives in every tree. She's the one who created me. Easter waking up the spring. I'm not sure to whom I should sing or from whom I should flee. God is why. God is why. God is why. You can't get around to the other side. You can't outrun them and you sure can't hide.
You've been listening to Queer Voices, heard each Monday at 8 p.m. here on KPFT, a publicly funded Pacifica Network station. Queer Voices is produced live in Houston with recorded segments from This Way Out, which is produced at KPFK in Los Angeles. Queer Voices executive producer is Jack Valensky. On-air voices are Glenn Holt, J.D. Doyle, Deborah Bell, Jennifer Renee, Greg Chapman, and Jack Valensky. Be sure to listen every Saturday night, Sunday morning at 1 a.m. for After Hours with Jimmy Carper. It's Queer Radio with Attitude. This is listener-sponsored and commercial-free Pacifica Radio, KPFT, at 90.1 FM, 89.5 FM Galveston, and worldwide via streaming audio from kpft.org. For Queer Voices, I'm Glenn Holt.
Hi, I'm Rick Mitchell, and I'd like to invite you to explore a world of entertainment April 21st through April 29th at the Houston International Festival, this year spotlighting China. Make the China Zone your first stop. Visit the Great Wall of China walking tour featuring a 100-foot-long reproduction of a section of the Great Wall of China. Check out the Shenzhen Acrobatic Circus and the Shaolin Kung Fu on the Wamu Center Stage. And, of course, don't miss the World Music Stage, sponsored by KPFT, featuring top artists like George Clinton and P-Funk, the Jazz Crusaders, featuring Ronnie Laws, Lucinda Williams, Angelique Kidjo, and more. Get early bird tickets until April 18th at any Houston area HEB location or online at ifest.org, or you can purchase tickets at the gate. Come downtown to the
free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.